waiting for you.
I can't finish.
When the towel says
hers, three's company. All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Hey Kids Comics. You have found us.
And that was strangely appropriate music for this episode.
It was. This issue. It was. It is Three's Company. I get to be the fake the fake gay. That's what I get to be. I don't know who's Chrissy.
Farley.
You want to be Farley? All right,
Farley. We can't have this sort of thing going on in this apartment complex.
That's pretty good. I'm going to give you that. So you've reached us at the second issue of our Three's Company cast, where we discuss the third and fourth seasons of Three's Company. Now, of course, this is Hey Kids Comics.
Those were the episodes written largely by Alan Moore, weren't they?
The bulk of the episodes were written. Yeah.
The one where Chris shot her foot off.
Except the towels would say his and hers and what?
Right. His and hers and Swamp Thing, Three's Company 2. This is the second issue of our Alan Moore story arc. Tentatively titled something in Latin that Cole's going to tell you right now.
That's right. Now, this is, of course, Moore on Moore.
Right.
The second chapter.
Second chapter,
we don't usually get this punchy this early in, mm-mm, but this is Alan Moore, so he's really affected our brain. This is Ego Ipse Custodis Custodio.
And with you, Cole.
Which is Latin for "I'm cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs."
Very well, Google Translate for the win.
Apparently, that's what I'm getting out of this translation. That is actually who watches the Watchmen.
Oh, very nice, very nice. And in this
effectively,
issue,
I think it was like who watches the Watchers.
Two very important things happen in this issue. Number one, we talk about Alan Moore's trip across the pond when he started watching The Watchmen, as it were,
yes,
and came to work for the big dogs over here in the U.S. And second, we are joined by a wonderful podcaster in her own right and dealer with all the shit that we throw at her, the lovely Catherine Houston, Mrs. Jedi Cole, joins us tonight.
Hey, it's great to be here.
It's been too long. It's been too long. So we've got her back. And we are going to talk about Alan Moore and his influence in the United States, how he got here, what he's done while he was here, who he pissed off, and who loves
pissed him off.
And who, which is everyone. Right,
yes,
now, he is pissed off.
The entire United States pissed him.
I mean, every time I ever see a picture of him everywhere, whether it's the back of a book or at a signing or accepting the keys to the city, he always looks pissed.
Right.
He just needs a haircut and he's mad.
When the clouds align in the sky to form Alan Moore's face, it's like, right, it's like God in Monty Python and the Holy Grail, really.
That's so true.
It's just that face, and you know. And that's the thing about Alan Moore, is his face is unmistakable. Like, you know Alan Moore's face when you see it. Sometimes, you know, you'll see Grant Morrison or Jack Kirby, never really Stan Lee, but, like, early pictures of Stan Lee, and you're like, okay, yeah, I see it. Alan Moore, you always know.
I'm glad somebody told me that was, yeah, Alan Moore, it's like, no, there's no question.
That's Alan Moore. But, yeah, so Jefferson joined us last issue to talk about his early works and what he's done and his influence and how he became the Alan Moore, which we're pretty sure he came out of the womb with that beard and his disposition. But
yeah, pretty much. Just a beard wrapped around his head, mad as hell.
So let's start here. I'm going to start by asking Catherine this question.
Okay.
What do you know about Alan Moore? Catherine, as you all know, and if you don't, you're about to learn, Catherine and Cole ran a comic book shop for a while. They've been ensconced. They've really taken up residence in comic book culture for most of their lives, and know their way around. Catherine does not have the benefit of having 134 issues of a comic book podcast under her belt.
This is true, and I also married into it. I started dating this guy who was into it, and found it was really absolutely fascinating. Because I'm sure you've heard the story before, so I'll keep it short. Is when I met this one over here, I'd never read a comic book before.
Yeah, she wasn't even one of those girls who, like, oh, yeah, I used to get Jughead's Double Digest.
Yeah, no, I read Pulp Fiction and stuff, and H.G. Wells and stuff like that.
We never demean the Moorcocks and the H.G. Wells and the C.S. Lewises, because there would be no comic books.
Yeah, it's just a whole different. It's fine. Yeah, so I think rather brilliantly, Cole got me reading something, a short 12-issue series that he had just started, that he was just a couple of issues into.
And what was that?
At Watchmen.
Of course it was.
Secret Wars.
Wars. Because I honestly think he thought this is my one big chance to impress this person who's
you don't want to show the kids episode one first. Same sort of idea. You don't really want to start with just any old thing or the worst examples. If you can, start with the best, and then just admit that it doesn't always get this good.
Right, and he I read the first two issues, and I'm like, oh, this is really awesome. Can I have the next one? He goes, oh, it comes out in about a week, and I'm like, excuse me,
that's how comic books work, you assholes.
Well, then the next one would come out. It's like, oh, we'll get the next one next week. I'm like, no, we'll get the next one in a month. But so this was a week. That's because we were 3 weeks into the month that I've been waiting.
Can I take a small aside here?
Yes.
Because of the current climate in media, this actually occurred to me earlier this week when we were talking. I was talking to somebody about comic books, as I do pretty much every day. What do you think? When does it switch to this Hulu, Netflix binge reading thing, where a new comic book's going to be announced, and before they release it to the public, they just release 12 issues of it? They're just like, here's 12. They're going to be on the shelves on this date. You can buy them all, or you can buy one at a time, or you can buy two or three, and then a year from now, another 12 will put out. Like, do you think that's a possible thing?
I think the comic book industry found out a long time ago that they sell crack, and they can take a perfectly decent length book and slice it with a razor blade and sell it to you in 20 issues.
Yeah,
that's kind of the same. It's
like a lot of vintage television.
Yeah,
just very shrewdly released, and like they'll split a season in two.
Uh huh.
Why? Because we can.
Yeah. Right. Right. And the other thing I want to address is the fact that apparently Cole spent the years after Watchmen came out just like wearing a trench coat with issues of Watchmen inside of it, and anybody just standing on a corner somewhere like hey kid, you want to try some death sticks? You want the Watchmen?
Yeah. This is such the truth. I mean, you were,
and it was even easier when the trade paperbacks
had,
right.
When the trade paperbacks came out, we had several that we had our business card taped to, and we would loan that out to people.
and
it would just like, okay, give me more of this. I got it.
So you literally used that as your first one's free. Like,
yeah.
That's right.
That's awesome. And
when we had the shop, too, when we had our own comic shop for a little while, and people would come in, and they were first-time comic readers, I would always show them Alan Moore comics to read, and also Alex Ross for the absolute beauty of the art,
right?
Because those are my two examples that I give of the absolute best that the media can be at the time.
Yeah. Oh yeah, and generally, Alex Ross's art was accompanied by very good writing, so it was sort of a safer bet all around. Anyway, mm-hmm.
the thing about Alan Moore, and the argument can be made that some of his books aren't as good as others,
right.
But like there's a big argument out there about Batman's The Killing Joke that it wasn't that great. That it was but the thing is, everybody still talks about Batman. It's not. Can you name what issue 347 of Detective Comics is? You can't. But if I go to anybody who is an intermediate comic book reader, I'm not talking a colon eye level comic book reader,
right?
but somebody who's read comics, somebody who's interested in comics, and mm-hmm. I say to them, "What do you know about Batman the Killing Joke?" They're going to be able to tell me about Batman the Killing Joke, at least in passing. We still talk about that book. So my thing is, and you know, people argue that Alan Moore's work became pedantic and derivative, but it became pedantic and derivative of his work. Of his
very
own
true.
Work.
He becomes he's almost like his own biggest fan, you know?
Right?
Because he hates himself.
But to be honest, though, I would always use him as an example because comic books now are in popular culture. You stop somebody on the street and you ask them about comic books, and they'll refer to the movies that are coming out, which are, you know, have come out within the last 10 years or so, which are all ages and stuff like that. Back when we had our shop, comic books were more kid stuff.
Right, right.
And
I don't know, though. They were already, even before then, they were starting to come around more.
I'm not talking about how they really were. I'm talking about how they were perceived.
No, I think even then, though,
by people who weren't familiar with them.
Even by then, they, you know, because you'd already had the 90s comic glut, you know. I think what had happened was that people stopped, you know, collector speculating and started reading all this stuff that they thought they were going to retire.
Because they had it all. They had thousands of comic books.
But, you know, it wasn't any longer the sort of thing, and especially even more so nowadays, where, you know, you get that mall rats. No, lady comics for kids. I don't read comic books.
Right.
They actually took you know, Lady Death out of the bag and flipped a few pages in, and they're like, holy crap.
But I don't, I honestly, right, good Lord, evil Ernie, or what, but I don't think that came around, and I don't think that changed until, it didn't happen in 89 with Batman. It started to happen in 89 with Batman, but it didn't fully transcend. You know, even with the Superman, because you had Superman, you had the Christopher Reeve Supermans, you had the Batmans, but mm-hmm. I don't think it fully transcended culture until we started seeing the Iron Man and the Thor and the Captain America, and then it really now it's acceptable. Now it's fully acceptable to have comics at work.
Exactly, and I think you guys were talking about the nature of Alan Moore himself. He always gave me the impression of being. You know how these avant-garde artists will you know, smear something on a canvas and then the crowd goes wild, but they're always just moody and cranky and all that.
Yeah, like the artist in The Big Lebowski.
Yeah.
Right.
And I think, Alan, what kind of I found almost amusing is Alan Moore would start, you know, he puts really edgy stuff into his work, and he's like, you know, they're all happy and now, but wait till they read this, and he puts in, you know, something about like in Top Ten.
He puts in rape is what he puts
rape in pretty much everything.
Pepper's thing,
that's going to be coming up in a later issue.
But also like in Top Ten, it's like here are deities as part of the, you know, part of the mainstream culture, and here's a devil worshiper put in the guise of a hero, and take that crowd and see how you like that. And of course it's beautifully realized, and in context it's amazing, and you know, and everybody loves it, and it's like, yay, this is great. And he's like, really, what does it take to piss you
right exactly off? he's like let's see how you like this, and everybody's like, it's awesome, and he's like, damn it.
Yeah, you would think, though, that, you know, the things that raise ire and controversy, I don't recall Alan Moore's work ever really getting the kind of attention that, you know, Iceman comes out as gay and all of a sudden that's national news.
He's got, and Alan Moore has lots of
Mr. Babies. Hyde rapes the Invisible Man and nobody bats an eye.
And there's a Top Ten about child trafficking and just all this.
And I think part of it, though,
stuff.
It's like, okay, if Iceman comes out gay, or the original Green Lantern or things, that, or, you know, God forbid you suggest that someone who is a Muslim could be a superhero.
Yes.
Then, but those things are hot button issues either because it's touching on something at a time when people are really getting stupid to the point of, you know, on religious issues, or you have a character that's been around forever. Where Alan Moore has this wonderful way of kind of quietly sneaking mm-hmm. in controversy in a world that's spoiling for controversy, especially
yes.
in a country that's spoiling for controversy in everything. And exactly. yet he's throwing all of the most provocative concepts out in front of people, and nobody is noticing outside.
But yeah, you would think that the comic book shop would be picketed every day for the stuff, all of the stuff that he's come out with, but it's never that. Like you said, it's that one random issue of Starman or something.
But for instance, you get okay. So what he does is he takes this controversy and he folds it into what are less mainstream or lesser known books. You've got John Constantine, you've got Swamp Thing, which at the time when he started Swamp Thing, and Swamp Thing had a lot of really interesting would be controversial issues handled
oh, very
in it.
Much so.
Yeah. Insane, yeah.
Oh yeah.
Constantine.
And things it was amazed that DC was publishing, because though and we'll kind of get to this a little bit later in this issue, one of the things that came out of Swamp Thing, of course, was the Vertigo imprint.
Right.
But Swamp Thing was Vertigo before Vertigo.
Right. No, it was. It was the birth. Swamp Thing was the birth of Vertigo.
Yeah.
And what? But what he did was, so he took the books that nobody, that he got put on, that or that he asked to be on, that very few mainstream readers, I'm talking mainstream readers, would read, and that would raise ire or controversy because they didn't understand the medium well enough. And he would inject that controversy into those books and really explore the crevices of his mind. But then you get a book like Whatever Happened to the Man of Tomorrow, or like the Green Lantern stories that we've discussed, and he takes a mainstream viable license commodity in the comic book world and just writes the most thoughtful, thought-provoking, uncontroversial in a lot of respects, brilliant stories about him, mm-hmm. and then goes back and hides in the shadows and does, because he loves
yeah.
controversy, and he hates to be the center of controversy, but he loves uh-huh. to cause controversy.
Yeah.
That's the thing. He doesn't want to be in it, but he wants to stand on the outskirts and be like, you're an asshole, and then like fade back into the, you know, into the shadows again. That's what he wants to do. He's like, oh, I never thought about Superman that way. You know,
exactly, and then it's gone, because you would go back to Superman and somebody else is writing it.
John Byrne took over after
yeah.
after Whatever Happened to the Man of Tomorrow, because it was the last issue before a reboot, so it doesn't
yeah.
matter. So you write this thing and everybody's like, oh, okay, but it's okay because it's getting rebooted, so it doesn't
yeah.
really work.
So it's sort of like the entire expanded universe for Star Wars. Yeah,
oh, here we go.
There are people.
Here we go.
But I honestly believe that Alan Moore is a genius. I don't say this just to flatter. I really think his artistic creative mind is at that level where he probably is just agitated all the time, because truly creative people, if they're not producing, They're just going nuts.
Yeah,
that's good. I mean, it's absolutely true. But if you look at so for instance, if we're going to talk about Alan Moore coming to the United States, he started, you know, he was hired by Len Wein, and he started on Swamp Thing, and that's where he got his big break at DC, because they loved what he was doing on overseas and working for Marvel UK in 2000 AD, and they said, let's get this weird ass guy over here and get him.
Well,
working.
You have to imagine that. Marvel Man had something to do with that, because what Marvel Man was doing was saying, this is the vast potential
right
in Captain Marvel, in the Shazam mythos. This is what, if you took it seriously,
right,
this is what you would get, and you didn't pull any punches. And, you know, that had to be part of, let's take this often forgotten, occasional, you know, under Bernie Wrightson and you know, early on, Swamp Thing was a fascinating type of character. Then it gets kind of remanded into your, like, you know, creature from the swamps who comes, and he's got a heart of gold, but he's sort of like Casper the Friendly Ghost made of slime, and it's, you know, and it's a big lot of who cares, and probably got down to the point of being a very, you know, just a dumping ground for the kind of crap stories that some titles get remanded to being.
Right, right. Which,
and then, you know, to when somebody says, why don't we do something with this? Because nobody really cares.
Yes, exactly.
And you get, you go to the person who takes, who looks at things in the ways no one ever has before.
But the thing is, and I think it speaks to Alan Moore's disposition now. Like, when you bring a man in, when you bring, okay, so let's say you need a chemistry teacher in a high school.
Okay.
And let's say you start approaching people. Let's say it's a super high-end, super famous high school. Let's say it's the most elite high school in the nation, but you need a chemistry teacher. So you say, okay, well, let's start approaching people to come work at our school and become a chemistry teacher. Mm-hmm. And you go to Neil deGrasse Tyson and you say, Neil, would you come be a chemistry teacher at our school? We've seen what you've done. You're amazing.
For even a semester. You know?
Right. We know that you taught your own courses. We know that you've, you know, done these amazing things that break our ideas of what chemistry and what astrophysics and science as a whole are. But will you come teach for us? You go there and you decide to teach, but you've got to understand, and I think that this is the problem, is you don't get to teach the way you want to teach. You're still mm-hmm. teaching at that high school, regardless mm-hmm. of how elite and how high-end, and regardless of what they give you to work with. You're now confined. You're now caged.
Yeah.
Alan Moore doesn't do well caged. That's the thing, and I think that's what you start to see.
I agree, because I'm following what you're saying, and it's reminding me somebody who was actually wanting to submit something to Marvel, and this was several years ago.
Yeah,
and I don't remember who it was or the context. If this is a dear friend of mine, I'm sorry, I don't remember. What they were given was a pre-drawn slugfest panel section.
Right.
And they were supposed to write the story that went with the pictures. And it's like, well, how handcuffed could you possibly be?
Well, in fact, yeah, we were talking about that actually on the last issue as well, that the nature of the lack of synergy between writer and artist that used to be the norm. And I think that's one of the things that Alan Moore does bring to America, is the idea of that's a foolish way of...
Yeah, right. What he does is literally literature illustrated to the ultimate degree.
That's true, but it's also really good literature. It's not just...
Because
there's
agree.
A lot of... Like, Brian Bendis... can give you a literary experience in a comic book. But the mm-hmm. way Brian Bendis does it is with a bunch of talking floating heads. Like mm-hmm. and that's great, and there are issues of there are one issue in every 15. That's great. Give me that, because that's a lot of exposition and I like it. What Alan Moore does, though, and it's almost a total, I agree with what you're saying, Catherine, but it's almost a total media experience where not only is it literature in the form of a comic, but it's also film in the form, good
yes.
film in the form
yes.
of a comic, because there's so
very
much
cinematic.
There's so much implied in
yes.
in the art that he's obviously very involved with, you know, in the scripting. It's all there. It's the ultimate comic experience for me if you read Watchmen, you know,
oh, yeah.
because so much is left unsaid that when he works with a guy like Dave, we're on a first name basis, Cole, it's okay. When he works with a guy like Dave, you know, the implied impetus of certain scenes,
oh,
it weighs more
yeah.
than the actual script.
Yes. Well, with that series, and I'm sure you touched on it at the time, you did the Watchmen episode, but you'd be on issue, I call it episode, number 7, and you'd see something on the street, and you go and you dig back to issue number 3, and you're like, dang, look at that. Look at that. That's, you know, oh, yeah, that's at a different angle.
Well, speaking of the cinematic nature.
Oh, my God. A, I remembered it. And B, it matches up perfectly, you know.
Well, that and, you know, the very cinematic nature of the storytelling in Watchmen and that extreme cooperation between writer and artist is very evident in the fact that if you go issue to issue, you can put together a map of the crossroads where the news vendor is. You can do a layout. So in everything on the page was, you know, illustrating a very real world. And if you look at other things, when things are happening on a street, even if it's on the same street, everything changes constantly because nobody bothers to try to compose, if you will, a world in which this is taking place. It, you know, if you were going to go shoot a film, you wouldn't shoot the same scene in 12 different street, city blocks.
Right.
And just cobble all the footage together.
Unless you were a student.
Or you were M. Night Shyamalan. Yeah, one of the two. Six of one, really. I mean, let's be honest. So, Cole, of his work, if you were standing behind the counter at Piece of the Action now, and somebody came up and said, hey, you know, I just read Watchmen. I really liked Watchmen. What of his U.S. works would you direct them to next?
Can he transcend time? Can he do stuff that
he can? But as long as it was, as long as, yeah, oh, of course, yes, now, yeah, now,
that's
like
what
today.
I'm saying. Like if today, the store was open today,
gotcha.
Yeah, like what would you direct people to?
I would have to say a good follow up because there's so much work, but that is excellent,
right?
But you know, if that's your first experience, and given the full body of work that's available, I would say, you know, your next step,
right,
the next logical stepping stone would probably be top 10.
Yep,
because
I agree.
That's going
I
to be
agree.
The most satisfying read because it is so, it's what you get with top 10 is like this multifaceted jewel because it's ultimately five or six individual stories that are all more or less tied together in an overarching existence.
And
each of them plays out in remarkably different ways.
Right.
And that each one could have independently been a story.
Right.
But they're all the better for being part of a greater world.
Plus, if you're a comic book fan and you've been associated with comics for quite a while, reading Top 10 is just a treat because the background is full of all of these wonderful random characters, and it's one of these things that if you don't know who they are, it doesn't hurt the storyline at all. But if you do know who you are, you're pointing at it. You're going, oh, that's that guy, and that's that guy. It's like a treasure trove.
Yeah, it's not so chock full. Yeah. I think it was Art Adams, if I'm not mistaken, used to like sneak little Easter eggs into his work.
Yeah.
Like you have a crowd scene, you might see Popeye out.
Yeah, there'd be all these weird, he was really all about that.
But,
yeah.
But what this is, you take that idea and you make it everything in there.
That's
and
right.
Sometimes it's things that are suggestive of things. Like, you know, the skyline is very much like Coruscant in episodes 1 through 3, and that there's all kinds of stuff going on in the sky as well as on the ground.
Right.
And one of the fun things there is if you look around at some of the skyborne vehicles, you might see something invoking Archie the owl ship from Watchmen and Bug. The bug ship was more or less based on, and like at one point, a scene where passersby are rubbernecking, and there's literally like this flying SUV or something, and literally something invoking every Elastic Lad and Elongated Man and Mr. Fantastic, and, you know, any stretching character you ever knew,
right,
is craning their extra long necks out of this vehicle to look at an accident.
Now, how they got away with all those homages, I guess it's just simply because it's Alan Moore. I think that's one of the Alan Moore just kind of got away with it because
they don't.
I mean,
but they never say it.
Yeah, they never say it. You can. the license states that if you're using it as satire or homage, you can use it as long as you never call them by name. So okay. He did whatever. I mean, it and it is Alan Moore. And the thing is, nobody, I've never heard of a comic entity coming at Alan Moore.
That's so true.
I've heard of, you know, writers and authors making disparaging comments. That's one thing, but I can't think of a story that's ever popped up on my radar that says DC Comics sues Alan Moore or DC Comics, you know, does this or that, because he's like the Steve Jobs of comics. He's so
yes.
powerful
that well that and you don't want to risk, like, you know, DC's not going to go after him. They may need him.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
He's like Stan Lee is now. It's like you're not going to do anything. You're not going to say anything. Yeah. Just
let it happen.
Because Stan's like a deity now.
But that is, you know, really, as Catherine was saying, the fun thing with Top Ten, in addition to having just amazing story, is looking for all those little Easter eggs, like at the hospital, and
yes.
finding the grouping of doctors.
Yes, yes.
You know, without them actually saying which doctors they are, but you see this group of doctors, and you realize, oh, wow, there's like kind of a shiny helmet and a cape, and there's a guy with like glowy stuff around his gloves and a big handlebar mustache, and there's a guy in armor, and
But the other thing about Alan Moore, and when you let him loose on a genre piece, mm-hmm. whether it's the superhero genre, the horror genre, you know, the Wild West, whatever it is, if you let him go to that place, comic books, and I'm saying this as a huge comic book fan, you know, somebody who's now, you know, his magnum opus is a comic book podcast. Comic books get boring, man. They get so, like, if you read 10 of 10 issues of the Avengers, mm-hmm. and you pretty much any time period, you've read 10 issues of the Avengers. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like you pick
yeah.
up the 11th issue, pretty sure you know what's going to happen. Alan Moore said, you know, okay, I get it. And again, this is why the authors that are so influenced by Alan Moore now are so popular, is because they get it too. They're like, let's change it up some. Let's give something back to the readers that have stuck with comic books for so long. Let's make this fun and interesting again.
Yeah.
Let's give something to the people who proved the dynamic in the late 90s wrong.
Right.
When everybody was certain, and we've talked about this many times on the show, the ever-ringing death knell of comics.
Right.
And, you know, people finally shut up. And they stopped worrying about the digital age killing the comic, or video killing the radio star, or
right.
whatever was going to happen. Because it was like, no, shut up. People actually do this. And it does my heart good to see new comic shops opening these days. Mm-hmm. Not because everybody's buying comics because they think they're going to put their kids through college. They're buying comics because they want to buy
and read
and enjoy
right.
these things.
As we always say, yeah. yeah. But you got
and
guys
I,
like, go ahead, I'm sorry, Catherine, go ahead.
And I think that, ironically, it's the, you know, having been a book fan myself, you know, book people kind of always saw comics as kind of, you know, that's nice. You know, there's real books, and then there's of course there's comics. Ironically, from my perspective, I think comics are surviving as a printed, tangible medium because of the art. And I think
much against my palpitations during the DC reboot.
Yeah.
whereas books are on you know, your Kindle, you know, books are all becoming electronic, but there's just something about holding that artwork in your hand.
That's a good point.
That, mm-hmm.
But also the thing is, Image tried to be a proof of concept that art was all you need.
Right.
And once all the Image crowd grew up, I mean, I remember, not least which, Chris Fulton kind of outgrowing that period, if you will.
Right.
And asking, you know, what should I be reading? You know,
yeah, exactly.
He's talking about the good stuff. And once he got his hands on that, it was like it changed everything. And, you know, but at the same time, you know, one of the things that Catherine brings up is like, you know, from a literary standpoint, comics were kind of looked down the nose of literary people. And in a funny way, that's actually, there's a nod to that in a sense in Miracle Man, or Marvel Man as he was known overseas,
mm-hmm.
in that the whole concept for creating this superhuman on the part of Emil Garganza, who acts as sort of the Dr. Savannah of the series,
right,
was finding a Captain Marvel. I mean, they go out right out. They aren't only ripping off Captain Marvel. They go out and say that this was inspired by a Captain Marvel comic that Garganza finds while working on the project. And what was amazing about that is he deliberately mentions, you know, that he finds this comic book left behind by an illiterate worker.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, you know, it's one of those things where if you put that in a comic day, people are like, what are you saying, comic book readers are illiterate? Like, no, you idiot. What that speaks to is the perception, because people tend to read the wrong things into what's being presented to them. And I think a lot of people would look at it like, oh, they're just trying to say that we're a bunch of idiots. Like, no, it's a perception that someone, especially a scientist, might have of someone who reads comic books instead of books. And I just thought that was really illustrated exactly that, as presented by one of the masters of changing that very perception.
Right.
So in a weird way, it goes full circle in the same way that sort of, you know, finding an old Fawcett comic book laying around on a work site brings that concept into reality within the context of Miracle Man.
And I agree. And again, Miracle Man was what happens when you let a unrestrained, uninhibited, brilliant writer attack the Superman conundrum. You know, and we've talked about that before. How do you, you know, and in researching this, we crossed paths with an article that was stating that that Squadron Supreme borrowed very heavily from the ideas postulated in Marvel Man, Miracle Man. And yeah, it did. So did the book Supreme. So did...
oh God, Supreme was so good.
You know, so did so many books. And Alan Moore's run on Supreme was amazing. But that all being said, none of them have been able to approach the depth and potency of Marvel Man or Miracle
yeah.
Man. You know, and that's the thing about Alan Moore is... the depth and potency of what he does, and the non-Euclidean angles that he sees life through and can
oh yeah, well he basically
like in Swamp Thing how he would have Etrigan
yeah
speaking rhymes that is still to this day I absolutely love that weird character simply because of that.
But the thing about it is, Etrigan was, from his outset, even like back in, you know, when he was created by Jack Kirby and whoever first conceived him, he was always a rhyming demon. That was his shtick.
Mm-hmm.
But no one ever put as much thought
into those.
Yeah, they were, I mean, Alan Moore proved not only is he an author, but he's a hell of a poet, because the subtlety of the verse was amazing and you know, I think that is literally the Etrigan's appearance in Swamp Thing is what inspired DC to publish, to give put a title out on open shelves called The Demon.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I mean, it wasn't since Marvel presents the Son of Satan, which amazed me. I mean, you know, especially in the Bible Belt here, that you could go to a comic shop and here's this thing called The Demon.
Right.
On open
with a
shelves.
Demon. With a demon on
with a
it.
Demon, yeah. You know, it's a story about a demon starring
a demon.
As the main character. But, you know, many an author has written Etrigan.
Right.
But no one put as much. I mean, they're not just like trying to force dialogues to match to rhyme. He was writing dialogues that were written for a character who speaks solely in rhyme.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, even as well written as Etrigan is in a brief appearance in Arkham Asylum Living Hell, you still don't get that amazing craft, poetry craft that you get with Alan Moore. And, of course, I think I've talked about this before on the show, when he is escorting Swamp Thing into hell to look for Abigail's soul, and he finds, when they first encounters Etrigan, and he's bargaining for, he and the Phantom Stranger are bartering on his services as an escort.
Yes.
And he collects the flower that the Phantom Stranger plucks when they're looking for her in heaven. And what's amazing about that not only is the fact that Moore does this wonderful little subtle recall thing, where, you know, the Phantom Stranger is one of those things you run into in comics where, you know, they get this mystical character and for some reason they like dress like some dude out of a Hammer horror film, or they dress like some rockabilly punk rocker, or, you know, what have you.
And it's a ringmaster.
Like, yeah, like, why would these entities dress that way?
Right. And
especially, you know, with Phantom Stranger with his, like, double breast, or his big suit coat and his hat and his big disco medallion and his turtleneck. What are you, like, auditioning for the next Doctor Who? But, you know, because he wears this sort of very earthly style of clothing, it's not unusual for him to, like, pluck a flower and put it in his lapel.
Right.
But it serves a purpose down the line. And then you get this wonderful line about how Etrigan chooses this artifact from heaven because he can take that down into hell and make everyone the more miserable.
That's a great line, yes.
Yeah, yeah. You know, something about the flower plucked from heaven's hill will make the abyss seem bleaker still, or something like that. Like, holy crap. That was just, I mean, you know, he not only does he write Etrigan's rhymes brilliantly, but he writes Etrigan brilliantly as an evil. I mean, as a demon. Yeah,
you forget how evil he is.
Yeah, even a demon.
A little reminder.
Yeah, even a demon who does good, good things, is still intrinsically an evil entity. And so he takes great pride in just being really nasty at times.
Well, and like, for example, in Top 10, King Peacock, you get to know him, and you're not quite sure what he's really about, but you see him in this selfless, brave, heroic role, and oh, by the way, he's a devil worshiper.
Right. Yes.
Yeah. And his power.
And there you are. I don't know how to feel about him.
Yeah, that and his, you know, he is a good person and a moral person.
Yes.
And what Moore does is turn the idea of, because there are so many things in our culture that are modern derivatives of reality.
Right.
You know, like the fact that, every year around, especially the holidays in the fall, where people have to remind everyone, you know, that's actually the same timing as pagan holidays. Well, of course it is, because who cares? But the thing about it is that, you know, when we think of devil worshippers, we think of, like, somebody wanting to erect a horned god in the front of the state house in Oklahoma, or sacrificing goats and baby salamanders or God knows what, and you know, wearing witch hats.
Right.
And the what Moore gives you...
The last family reunion, by the way.
Yeah, right?
Yeah, I remember that.
That was Sunday at 6 o'clock at Alcon. I don't know
good
what
times.
You're talking about.
But what Moore gives you is Satan as just another entity that has a religion based around him.
Right.
Right.
And it's probably, I've never really done the research, but it was probably based on some doctrines of some satanic-based religion.
Right.
That isn't, you know, well, we bow to the mother of the devil, you know, that sort of thing. And
well, and to speak to the influence after that fact, you know, if you look at Neil Gaiman's work for DC, borrowed very heavily from those ideas. You know, like all of his work, like this idea that, you know, Lucifer exists and it isn't, you know, oh, I'm the scared devil, I've got the horns. You know, it's I'm just, you know, I'm a deity, granted, but I'm doing my thing, and yeah, I got machinations, but no more so than any other deity. I'm just
exactly,
you know,
yeah,
or Sandman, yeah, even, like, you know,
it's
like,
not like Satan is the is being red and scaly with a bifurcated tail and carries a hayfork,
right?
For those of you who are big fans of O Brother, Where Art Thou?
but yes, I. There's just something about the way that, and it's, you know, I think that the impetus of this issue isn't so much Alan Moore comes to America. You know, it's not Eddie Murphy and Arsenio Hall.
Exactly.
It's Alan Moore's take on the superhero, the modern, what we know as Americans as comic books.
Right.
Because
he changed
everything.
Yeah, he came in and retold the myth.
Yes.
He gave us, and I think what's brilliant is you bring Alan Moore in on Swamp Thing, and he illustrates through the earliest stories in Swamp Thing what he does best, and that is to take a character apart and put them back together.
Literally.
So, yeah, literally. So it's not surprising that one of the earliest stories is called Anatomy Lesson.
Mm-hmm.
And you literally deconstruct a seemingly dead Swamp Thing so that Swamp Thing can discover what he is and has always been.
Right.
And it opened up a whole new world at DC. I mean, the contribution that Moore's work on Swamp Thing would ultimately redefine Animal Man and redefine so many aspects of the DCU. It redefined... it brought magic and the occult to the forefront in DC in ways that most people don't realize. Because while the crisis on Infinite Earths was going on, there was a quiet crisis going on in Swamp Thing.
Right.
Where the Unvunchichi, or whatever,
way up in the trees lived the Munchichis.
Yeah. Oh, so soft and cuddly.
Oh,
but they,
services, no.
You didn't need let's go to the big board.
Yeah.
Let's go to the big board.
Okay. But they actually utilized them in the Constantine television series.
Yeah, they did.
And not nearly as frighteningly as Alan Moore does.
Correct.
But what he did was that you had, simultaneous to the crisis on Infinite Earths going on, in the mystical realms, there was a whole little shadow war going on as well that portended the end of the universe itself.
Right.
And what was fascinating about that is when you realize the chronology, you're like, whoa, wait a minute, that was going on. That's actually supposed to be concurrent. And that's why Constantine's first appearance is actually in Crisis on Infinite Earths.
Right, right.
Very briefly, just kind of, hey, what's going on? Gotta go. Big things brewing. Have fun storming the castle. And
you guys got this, right? You guys got this. Okay, I'm going to go.
Yeah, meanwhile, he's having to not only teach Swamp Thing what he is, but do so in the nick of time so that he can be instrumental in preventing a prophesied apocalypse.
Mm-hmm.
And Prophesied Apocalypse is actually my next album.
It's a prog rock album. It's like it's like 5 hours long. It's a box set.
Yeah, it's like a tone poem.
While you're talking about Swamp Thing and Saga of the Swamp Thing, one of the aspects of it that I enjoyed so much is the concept of love in it.
Yeah.
I think Alan Moore in his moments can write genuine love between two people. So much of comic book love is getting your girlfriend to third base. But a lot of the stuff and you see so much in Alan Moore's work is if he wants to take it down the love path, then you've got these two people who are just totally connected by the soul.
Right.
And you actually can sense that connection, and it's moving. At least it is to me. So.
No, I totally agree, and I think that Alan Moore has a grasp of human emotion that strips any other writer of comic of mainstream comic books down to the quick. Like there's no comparison.
Right.
Sorry, Cole, what were you saying?
Oh, no, it's because one of the things he does is create these characters that are so human.
Mm-hmm.
That when, you know, they're falling in love isn't just sort of, hey, Tiger, you hit the jackpot.
God.
Just you can get two characters, you know, they're not like Legos where you just, you know, take one and click it to the other. You actually get the progress.
Right.
Of... You know, Abigail Arcane was married to a real creep.
Oh, yeah.
Before she, before he wound up having a tragic accident and getting possessed by her dead uncle. And things got worse. But, what you saw was, her progression out of that dark part of her life.
Right.
And into the light with someone who, you know, her love for Alec Holland as he exists as Swamp Thing transcended whether or not that was actually Alec Holland.
Right.
It didn't matter because she fell in love with the man, whether it was the man or a facsimile thereof.
Exactly. No.
Which makes you explore who, what, and how. Is that love, that the actual love connection?
Yeah.
Is it with the mind, the body, the heart, the soul, or something, a combination thereof? And anyway, I could go on and on.
But the thing is, so we've talked on the show, and comic book fans know the refrigerator moment. The moment that Major Force shoves, kills Green Lantern's girlfriend, Kyle Rayner's girlfriend, and shoves her in the refrigerator. And it was done for shock value, right? Yeah. That's why it was done. It was done to elicit an emotional response from the reader. And to sell comics. But moreover, as all bets are off, this is supposed to affect you because they're in a relationship. Alan Moore has never... Now, granted, Alan Moore's done some pretty,
he's done some shocking things.
Pugnacious things with his characters. But he's never had to go to that length to show you... To make you feel heartbreak, he can do it with, with his writing. He doesn't need to throw it in your face. And, he does it. And he can do it without killing anybody. He can do it without shoving anybody in a refrigerator. He can do it with two people that are still together and still in love. He can make you feel that.
Yes.
And he does it over and over again. he did it in every issue of The Watchmen. He's done it in Swamp Thing. He's done it in every book that he's written. He did it in Captain Britain, for shit's sake. It's Captain Britain. Who takes that seriously? Apparently Alan Moore did, and did more with it than anybody has done or will do.
And also, thankfully, finally, no longer mired in litigation hell, a whole new generation, literally, of readers can experience Miracle Man, albeit in a slightly... I'm interested to see what Marvel's going to do with the... The one point where Alan Moore probably treaded on the border of shock value was the infamous childbirth issue of Miracle Man. The point where the cover had a giant legend, warning, graphic depiction of childbirth. And that, on its surface, that's because they felt compelled out of necessity to present that kind of warning. It almost seems like, oh, here's the shock issue.
Right, right.
But the reality is, if you ignore that and you read the story, it's a very well-written, well-conceived, and in very much an Alan Moore vein, pulling no punches, unflinchingly depicting the character in the form of this super entity that he can become, that he had forgotten he could become, basically acting as midwife for his child, who was actually conceived from the superhuman body's genetics, not from the human.
Mm-hmm.
And which gets into some seriously creepy stuff.
Right.
Like when she, Liz is still pregnant and Garganza's, you know, monitoring the fetus. And there's this wonderful, talk about the beautiful synergy with writer and artist, you know, where he's looking at the fetus and all of a sudden it looks up at him and opens its eyes inside the womb.
Yeah, because it can see him through
and through her. Know, yeah, and knows it's being observed.
Who would do that?
And he just
who
freaks.
Would do that?
Actually, the hair is standing on my arms just remembering that panel.
Yeah.
Because it was that damn good. But the thing about it is, yes, you do see him actually birthing a baby. And
right.
It's not like Padme behind a protective screen or something.
Yeah.
Like Deanna Troi's miracle 3-second birth there. But what he does is say, you know, here is a very human story juxtaposed against a very superhuman character.
Right.
So you get this guy who can, you know, crush juice machines with his eyeballs. Cradling.
I've got to really examine what you just said. Crush juice machines with his eyeballs.
Yeah, because that's a very British thing.
I guess it is. Okay, go on. Yes. I'll accept it.
If it was over here in the States, it'd be soda pop machines. But.
No, it were juice machines, because that's what Mr. Neutron could do. That was from Monty Python. Mr. Neutron, who can crush juice machines with his eyeballs.
See, I always thought in that episode, that issue, that either they were A, just trying to sell more comics by trying to think of something to put on the cover. It says danger, you know.
Yeah.
But either that or, you know, you can all day long you can strangle people with their own intestines, but man, you spill the beans on where babies really come from.
Right,
you
it's
are,
over.
Yeah. Well, for one thing, Cabbage Patch Kid sales plummeted. But the thing, what I love about that is, you know, childbirth is not a simple process. And
no.
I am all for anything. You know, it was like Children of Men style. It was like if Henry Cavill flew in like Superman and shot the scene from Children of Men. Because what that juxtaposed is the fragile newborn. You know, this little girl being born whose skull isn't even all knitted together yet. And that's not going to happen for months, by the way. It's just nature.
That's just the way it works, all right?
Yeah. The head comes through the birth canal. It gets a little out of shape. But you have this, you know, entity here who can, you know, fell mighty oaks with his pinky, cradling this newborn as she's emerging from the womb. And to me, what that does is the necessity of the graphic depiction of the child exiting the mother's vagina is that you get this juxtaposition of newborn life in the hands of this alien genetically engineered entity that shouldn't exist, yet, you know, he's crackling with raw energy, and yet he is performing one of the most ancient and necessary functions, and also, you know, illustrating that one of the things I love is the idea of being able to do anything, and yet part of being able to do anything is doing things that normal people do.
Right.
Right.
Without, you know, like in the, you know, to jump to different authors, but like with the Teen Titans under Marv Wolfman and George Perez, where, you know, when Cyborg first gets his artificial enhancements, having to learn to do things like crack an egg. Or pick up a glass and not just shatter it.
Right, right.
And what that did was, here, you know, Miracle Man, he's never been a midwife. And he doesn't have that learning curve of being able to, you know, hold back 99.99% of all this energy and power to bring himself down to, like, gynecologist level or OB level, you know.
Gynecologist level.
He had gynecologist powers.
You know? Speaking of, wait.
That's like a low roll on D&D.
That's right.
Wait, hold on. Cole and I have discussed in previous issues specializations in professional fields that would be necessary in a real superhero environment, and we never discussed the need for a superhero gynecologist specialist. But now that we're on that topic, we might need to discuss that.
Well, of course, and you do, of course, get the symbolism of he's the superhero, and here's humanity in the palm of his hands, completely helpless.
All right. We got to start wrapping this up.
She like had within like 2 months, she was flying off to Jupiter or something.
All right, we got to wrap this up. Yeah, I know the hour's up.
Fun.
I gotta be the fun sucker. Fun sucker. So we got to wrap this thing up. Catherine, do you have any final thoughts on Alan Moore's time on mainstream comics?
Oh, I wish he would do more. I wish, not trying to make a pun, but
that's all he does.
But wait, there's more.
I would really like to see him do more futuristic stuff, but not superhero future, but more like
speculative fiction.
Yes, speculative fiction like Verne and Wells and used to write, where just speculative. What is it going to be in the year 3030? And I'd like to see it.
Okay, you would like to see it, yes.
That's what I would like to say.
Awesome. Cole, what about you?
I like that, because that is something to see where his mind would take him.
Yes.
In that kind of speculative fiction genre.
And in my next life, I'll get to enjoy it.
Yeah. I'd like to see something. You get a little bit of this through the various myriad, and the more I look into it, numerous beyond what I ever expected incarnations of the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. I'd like to see him take that same sort of idea in the sort of alternate history genre, if you will.
Right.
Like the Harry Turtledove kind of sort of thing, where, not just like take, different well-known figures in history and juxtapose them the way they did with the fictional characters of the same eras, but rather take historical events, and I'd like to see his take on, like the even something Shakespearean like Henry V.
Right, that would be cool.
And take a different approach to maybe, Agincourt didn't work out so well. And, take maybe where, the struggle to...
what if Romeo and Juliet snapped out of it, and,
Yeah.
That's good. That's
got
good.
A life.
I, as far as mainstream comics go, right... I want to see him be put. I want to see him as EIC of Marvel or DC. I want to see him as editor in chief. Just give it to him for a year. Just let him. Let's see what he does. Just let him go. Just take him off the chain. Let him do whatever he's going to do. I mean, what do we got right now going on in Marvel? We've got Secret Wars. What do we got going on at DC? We got the Convergence thing, which is another Crisis on Infinite Earths.
Yeah.
That's what it is. We've got a Secret Wars. We've got that well being dipped into yet again. And on the other side of this, we've got another Crisis on Infinite Earths.
Yeah, I mean, what's next at Marvel? Infinity Beach Party?
Right. Beach Blanket Infinity Wars is next.
Yeah, because that's all they do anymore. Is Atlantis going to attack again? Are we going to Serpent crown it up? What's next, Marvel?
Well, the 90s are coming back, so it'll be babies.
Well, they've already... Babies. They've already done... I mean, if you look at Secret Wars, what they've done is... And I like it better than what DC did after a fashion, because they said, all right, guys, you've stuck with us this long. We're going to give you some nods before we wipe everything out, because that's what they're doing. They're restarting the way DC did. It just took them 3 years longer.
That way, for a change, they wouldn't seem like they were just copying.
Right. They're doing a... they're doing all of their... their ultimate story arcs in these little vignettes, so you get to go back and revisit Hulk, the Planet Hulk storyline, or you get to go back and revisit the Inferno, or heaven forbid, Atlantis attacks, or the 90s comics. Like they're doing all these little vignettes for you. That's great. Give it to Alan Moore. You want to really change things up? You want to really throw a monkey wrench into the way everything works? let Alan Moore have complete control over your all your licenses for a year and see what happens. That's my thing. Yeah,
or take over Archie Comics.
Oh well, Archie Comics is the only. If you aren't following Archie Comics right now, you need to do yourself a favor and go start following Archie Comics.
Really,
what we've got is this: they've rebooted Archie, and they've made it.
Well, for one thing, recently, like about less than a year or so ago, wasn't Archie shot and killed?
He was shot and killed. They brought him back as they started Life After Archie, which is a zombie comic based on Archie Comics. It is canon. Everything they've done, they've completely turned everything on its ear. They brought Sabrina the Teenage Witch back as a horror book. Like,
I heard about that.
And it's amazingly good. Like, Archie's doing all these really weird, amazing things right now. They've decided...
As a zombie?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah,
because the Sabrina the Teenage Witch thing just kind of put me in the mind of what was that, the Mockingbird Lane, whatever that was, where they tried, unfortunately, unsuccessfully, to take a new twist. It was sort of like Alan Moore's The Munsters.
Right. No, yeah, exactly. But they've done it with all their books, and they've made it so good. And I would love to see something like that with a mainstream, you know, with one of the big two, just completely turned it on its ear. Yeah. All right, so...
Think of what he could do with Richie Rich, turn it into a one-percenter,
hunting,
you know...
He's hunting people in the woods, like weird... Exactly, give him something
that
real
other
crazy.
Kid, you know, who would always... He was always having the competition with on who could outmoney the other. It was like, you know, hey, look, I got a Diamondback Terrapin, but mine has real diamonds. You son of a...
Exactly.
Take that, PETA.
All right, so we're ending this now. We've got to end the Sicilian thing. We've got to end it. So next week we are going to have an issue on the legends of Alan Moore. I think we're going to be joined by Starman Morrison, who's been on the show once before. We're going to bring him back around for this. Just all the weird, you know, the stuff like where he supposedly met Constantine and all of his and all of his, you know, what he was going to write, his magnum opus that he was going to do for DC. that he claims was later turned into Kingdom Come. All kinds of weird, bizarre Alan Moore-ism things that we're going to talk about.
The next issue, I Am Legend,
Perfect. Perfect. So let's get into the first... And Catherine, thank you so much.
Yes,
thank you. I had so much fun. Thank you for having me.
This is amazing.
This was purpose-built for you to join us because, you know, that this was... Alan Moore was your entree.
Yeah.
Into comics,
you chose wisely.
all right.
Because like, it really was that or Secret Wars at the time.
So Secret Wars. Yeah, don't give her Secret Wars. That's a bad. That's awful. All right, Cole, plug us up, will you?
All right. Well, we are of course coming to you through the auspices and the offices and the.
Ostriches
of the Jedi Cole universe at JediCole.com. And in just about a week and a day from now, if I'm not mistaken, you can find Andy and I on Hey Kids Comics Live at DeepAlamOnAir.com with our very special guest, Midnight Movie Cowboys Australian office correspondent, Stuart Ball.
He'd be so mad if he actually listened to this show.
I know. We're going to find out if I get a call. I am, what the bloody thing was that all about? So, also on Deep Ellum On Air, which is also the home of the Rancor Pit Live every other Sunday, and the second Saturday of every month, the Hey Kids Comics Live. At DeepAlamOnAir.com, you can write to us, and please write to us at JCUmail@yahoo.com. I am occasionally tweeting on the Twitters at the Jedi Cole U. You can find Andrew and Catherine and I at various intervals at various times on various shows of the United States of Geekdom at UnitedStatesOfGeekdom.com if you're looking for us elsewhere. And we're on the verge very soon of bringing video content to the Jedi Cole.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, boy.
Be watching our YouTube channel, as that will be... providing more and more in the very near future. We are building in the top secret. Damn it!
Nine!
Video studio.
War room.
Yes.
The Doctor Strangelove war room.
We're building a big board.
As soon as we can clear whatever's living in it out.
Of course, if you live in or near Texas, or you just kind of keen to know what's going on in Texas in our vibrant convention scene.
Super vibrant.
Super vibrant, because there will, by the end of the year, there will have been over 100 conventions in Texas, which
that's
I'm
insane.
Very happy about. It's insane, yet I couldn't be happier. And if you want to find out about all of these, all that remain of those 100-plus conventions, go to Convention Awareness Project Texas at cap-tx.info.
That's right.
Because you can't go if you don't know. And there's a couple of conventions we really want you to know about.
Absolutely.
And that is, of course, the JCU will be making an appearance. We have a booth at Texas Comic Fest coming up in Louisville. In June. And in August, the Jedi Cole Universe is making its first foray and my seventh foray, or eighth foray, good Lord, into conventions with the Jedi Cole Universe comic toy and collectible swap meet. Yes, it's back after a six-year hiatus, formerly a piece of the Action's comic toy and collectible swap meet. We will be hosting in Arlington, Texas at the Bob Duncan Center in Vandergrift Park. You can find out about that convention and oh so many more on the Convention Awareness Project Texas.
And as for our weekly Lubicon plug,
yes.
Not only have vendor apps been up and still available for all of you out there that are listening and want to vend there, but volunteer apps are up now too. So if you're interested
nice.
In volunteering, go look that up. There's some big, huge, giant announcements coming up in the next month and a half. So go find them on Facebook. Go find them on their website. Go to Lubicon. Come find me, and I'll tell you all about it. And
I also just noticed just this moment that hashtag no pants, all cardigans.
It's trending on nowhere. It's trending nowhere.
Wow.
It is patently failing to trend.
It's fail. Yeah, it is getting driven. It's actually negative trending. It's being driven into the ground right now. So all that being said, we're going to wrap it up. Thank you again, Catherine. It was a great, great show. And I'm going to end it in a traditional way. Everybody out there, buy, collect, and enjoy comics. And if you don't know where to start, start with Alan Moore. All that being said, say goodnight, folks.
Good night, everybody.
And good night, everybody. Join us next week when we talk about weird legends of Alan Moore.